Welcome to the Teacher Nerds Podcast. Joe and Ron are self-proclaimed teacher nerds, geeking out on all things education. They are looking to move educational practices out of the 1900s factory worker model to a student-driven classroom full of empathetic, creative, and collaborative students willing to take risks. Join them as they chat with educators from around the world, discussing educational tools, techniques, ideas, policies, and much more. Thank you for listening and becoming one of the Teacher Nerds. And now a word from a sponsor.
Oh, have you heard about the nerds? What's the word? Teacher Nerds. You can tweet them out on Twitter. You can find them on the gram. After listening to their podcast, you'd be sitting there like, bam! Trying to take the teaching from one level to the next. Reaching up to Canada and down to Mexico. Gotta go. Teaching Nerds. Start the show.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of the Teacher Nerds Podcast. I'm Ron Nober.
I'm Joe DiPaolo.
I am a technology teacher for third grade to eighth grade.
And I teach third grade.
And today we have our guest with us is Christy Nober, and Christy is my sister-in-law, but she's also a doctoral student in education. So welcome, Christy.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to start off, before we get into anything, we'll start off with our little icebreaker, our two yes mores, one no way. And today we're doing Star Wars villains. And I know my niece is a Star Wars fanatic. So I figured Christy had to be a Star Wars fanatic as well, whether she liked it or not.
not as good as she is, but I'll try for sure. Right. I might call
it's her. Time for two yes more, one no way.
You going to start us off with our two yes mores, one no way Star Wars villains?
Yeah, definitely, Ron. And it's cool because today's what, the 13th, I believe, July 13th?
Yep.
So on July 12th on TBS yesterday, they played the trilogy, the Star Wars and then The Empire Strikes Back. So it's really fitting that all three are going to fit right into that trilogy. And the first one, Boba Fett, hands down, especially with like the Mandalorian out there. Boba Fett has always been a top favorite of mine. Another villain I do like is Darth Vader, you know, like probably the villain, I guess, in the trilogy. And to see him in episode one and progress through everything, I think is pretty cool. So my no way is the Emperor. Not big on the Emperor, and whether he's the Emperor, whether he's Palpatine, you know, not. And it's hard to pick a villain because he is such a good villain. But if I had to choose, I would say no on the Emperor, just because of the way he looks. Like, he's kind of scary to me. And now Darth Maul was scary looking, but maybe as a kid, you know, the first movie I saw in the theaters was Return of the Jedi. And I was a young, impressionable kid. And I don't know, it just stuck with me. Like, he's a scary dude.
Yeah, I get that. All right, Christy, you're going to jump in?
So I have to think, and I'm going to have to go more recent, I think, because that's where we sort of started with Sadie Watch. And so I would have to say Kylo Ren. He's a big one in our household. We have you wouldn't think Kylo Ren's a villain in our house because we have everything Kylo Ren. And it's curious about him because you really do, as a villain, you grow to love him. And he's torn, you know, between light and dark. And so it's pretty cool to see him have that realization. Then I would have to say, old school. I forget which one he's from. I want to say some of those like prequels, or not even the prequels, the episodes. General Grievous. Ooh. He had some cool. That's kind of, I think, where Anakin was more of like a teenager and turned dark. And he, I don't know, we always loved his weapons and his crazy arms and like multiple lightsabers. So he was cool, and he's a big fan favorite here. The no way for us would have to be Snoke. And again, the more recent ones. And Joe, to your point, I think when we were watching, I was like, whoa, who is this guy? He's creepy.
Yeah.
real hard to look at, real hard to watch. You know, so he's definitely one where we're like, oh, we're going to flip the channel when he comes on or cover our eyes. you know, she's six. So, you know, definitely a little more scary to her. But yeah,
definitely not one of my favorites. And it's because I'm not big on that movie, which I forget which movie that actually is. But you're one of your favorites is in that movie. Right. And he's yep. where we really see, you know why? And I think why I don't like, because that's where the drama comes in. I think he's a little bit of a crybaby myself. Not a cry, but like Ron knows me very well. So that there's a lot of drama involved with him. And I guess you talked about the good and the bad and the back and the forth. But yeah, I don't like that character as well. and it's funny where I went with mine is me as a kid or my memories as a kid. And you talked about your daughter's memories where she's getting into it. That's why I think that Star Wars Enterprise is so awesome because it can hit so many different generations.
And it's funny. I had brothers who were obsessed. My two brothers were obsessed with Star Wars and I had no interest, no real like, you know, interest in the toys, the games, the movies. And it wasn't really until, you know, we would do Disney World and it's like, oh, Star Wars, the big thing. I'm like, I don't get it. It was fun, but I don't get it. And for whatever reason, Sadie took to it. And so then we had marathons during quarantine. Let's watch them all. And I had to Google figuring out which one came first, which one, you know, what do you watch first? It was actually a timeline. And then there's 8 million other movies, but it is interesting. But it is cool because it can span across all those different ages.
Yeah, definitely. That's cool. That's cool. She's into it.
So my two, all mine kind of go with the older Star Wars, you know, the Star Wars Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi. And first and foremost, I loved the Stormtroopers just in general. Like I just thought they were, I don't know, there was something about them. They were just cool. Like I loved the Stormtroopers. And Joe, I have to go with you. Darth Vader was like, he was like the, you know, it always reminded me of like the, when I was a kid, like some of the wrestling bad guys that you loved, you know, yeah. And that was Darth Vader was that kind of guy, that kind of character that you just, you almost loved to hate, but you loved as well. And it was just cool. And I think my no way, and it goes again to like, just not very pleasant to see Jabba the Hutt. it just gross. You know what I mean? Just was not a fan of Jabba the Hutt, and like just even his voice was like, dude, spit it up or whatever. Like it sounded like he had a whole bunch of mucus in his mouth, and it was disgusting. So yeah, Jabba the Hutt was not one for me.
How about the little guy that he used to have on
Brody? Yeah. And then what was he? He would like reach in the bowl with like it was like fish or something that he would just like.
Ugh. Almost like a frog, like a frog.
Yeah, type. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, frog. Yeah. Disgusting. So, yeah, Star Wars villains. That was a good one.
Well, that's a go off of.
And now we're going to take a little break, but we'll be back in a moment. Are you looking to encourage your students to think about important political, cultural, economic, geographic, and gender issues? Bring Girl Rising into your classroom. Girl Rising is a powerful film that travels the globe following 9 unforgettable girls who face daunting barriers to their education, but stand up to them with fortitude and determination. Curriculum from Girl Rising includes teacher guides, project-based lessons, and issue fact sheets. There's even a Flipgrid library with over 30 topics for teachers and students. It doesn't matter whether you teach elementary school, middle school, high school, or college. Engage and empower your class. Visit girlrising.org to get started today. And now back to the show.
All right. So Christy, can you give us a little bit of background about yourself? Like where you started with education and where you are now and what you're looking forward in the future?
Sure. So for me, it wasn't always, you know, I feel like whenever you talk to an educator, it's always like, oh, I always knew I wanted to be a teacher. I wanted to help kids. Was never really my initial goal. When I started looking at college, I was really kind of the wrapped up jock. I really wasn't paying attention to schools as much as I should have. I played soccer and I was pretty good. So I was being recruited for a couple of different schools, you know, in a field hockey and soccer. So for me, I was like, oh, I'm a jock. They're just going to pick me and I'll figure it out when I get there. And long story short, I ended up at Holy Family. And when I started, I had all intentions of being a biology major. Actually, I envisioned, I kind of looked at Temple. I looked at a couple of programs, and I thought I wanted to do biology to eventually go pre-med. I just thought it was the track I wanted. So that's kind of how I started Holy Family. I was playing soccer. I started out as a bio major, but about 18 months, I guess, into the year, you know, my career at Holy Family, they dropped the biology program. So at that point I was like, crap, now what? And my sister had gone to Holy Family and she had done education. And, you know, she'd been a teacher for years. And at the moment, like I was already almost 2 years in and I was like, I can't like transfer. I don't want to transfer. I'm playing soccer. It was great. It was perfect location. So really it kind of education was like the fallback. You know, I said, I can always figure out how to double back to what I want to do later. So that's how I actually ended up in education at Holy Family. And then from there, well, once I was in it, I loved it. You know, I loved the folks that were in my class. The professors made it engaging. As I went through, I actually got to work on Holy Family's campus. They had a kindergarten, nursery, and kindergarten program called Alpha House, where I was able to do my student teaching. I was able to kind of get involved, which is really kind of what opened up my interest really into the early years of education. So I actually, after graduation, stayed on with Alpha House as a substitute teacher because I graduated. I was like in mid-year because of a sports injury. So I was done in December, not graduating till May. So I stayed on as a substitute teacher, you know, made connections there, loved it. And then I took a position down in North Philly the following year, full-time position teaching second grade Catholic school. And I absolutely hated it. I hated it, like to the point where I went back to get my nursing degree. I enrolled back in, I had enough credits. I was going to go in and I was like, you know what? If I dedicate a year, I can work. I'll take my classes at night. I hated it so bad. It was just nothing I had envisioned. I'm not sure if I was just young and naive and, you know, I wasn't sure what I figured out in that moment. So I was taking classes now. I was trying on my nursing degree track and I got a call from somebody at Alpha House where I was working that the grade school down the street needed a second grade teacher. And they're like, listen, we already pitched your name. So, okay, great. Went up there, fell in love, basically stopped where I was in the nursing program and stayed at Nazareth for 10 years. I was teaching second grade and third grade. So I was there for just about 10 years. And that's really where I found like my passion, I think, where the families, the students, the community, it all just made sense. It made me want to do more. So while I was there is actually when I went back and got my master's with my principal certification. And I actually had, as a part of my master's program, I had an opportunity to rewrite and develop a strategic plan for Nazareth, which was a huge, you know, undertaking. I had, you know, I was a chair of a committee. I had community members, board members, committee, you know, like politicians that we had a couple on there, basically just figuring out how we can make the school financially and fiscally responsible to move into the future. And that was another area where I was like, this is where I want. This is like the policy end, the developing end. That is really where I think I got my administrative lens and wanted to pursue going further into that end and kind of coming out of the classroom. So a hard decision was when I decided that in order to grow, I had to get out of my bubble. You know, I'd been in this little bubble of Frankfurt Avenue up in the Northeast. So I started looking around and an opportunity presented itself at a charter school in, you know, the urban section of the city. And it wasn't really my goal. It wasn't really my thought. It was middle school. Wasn't really happening. But I took it and I took a chance. And ironically enough, after 3 years or so of being there, it ended up being middle school is one of my favorite years. So that was fun. And it was something that I didn't think I would, it was a whole new perspective. It was eye opening. And what happened there, because I went from being in this private Catholic academy, you know, in this little bubble to this urban setting where the disparities, the disadvantages were so much more in your face than we had seen up in the Northeast. And, you know, it was really eye opening and some of the things that, you know, we really needed to see change. So from that, I then took my
career. You were there as a teacher.
Yep. Fifth grade teacher. So I took on fifth grade teacher there. And it's funny because I went in as a second, I think it was like a second or a third grade position and they mixed up something and they already hired somebody. But they're like, we don't want you to leave. Like we have fifth grade. I was like, oh, no. Like I do littles. I'm not doing big kids. They're big kids. I don't know how to handle them. And I'm like, they're bigger than me. Like they probably know more than I do. Like I can outsmart like a second and a third grader. I can't really outsmart them. And they're like streetwise. I wasn't like, and to my own ignorance now, which as we've kind of worked out through some equity stuff in my position now, you know, some of my own ignorance is that like I was learning that I just didn't know. And I'd be like, go out and play. And they're like, we can't, you know, like just different things that came up. I was like, really eye-opening. And really, though, it really helped me appreciate that age. And it is honestly still, even though I'm back in with the littles, it really is still one of my favorite ages just because of what they know and because of they'll check you and, you know, they'll put you back on the ground when you need to be. And it's helpful. So that was, it was really like, that was a really eye-opening experience. And I was actually able to do some leadership stuff while I was there too, which again, kind of honing in on getting those administrative skills. And my neighbor was involved with School District of Philadelphia. And he's like, come on, there's so many opportunities. If you want to go down this road, you have to take the jump. And he was right. I had to get out of my bubble. I had to get out of my comfort zone. And that's really what ended up leading me to the district. And then I really stepped out of the classroom and became an instructional coach with the pre-kindergarten program. So I worked on a comprehensive team as the academic coach to go in and support the teachers, help them, you know, better lesson plan, better planning intentionally, compliance type stuff, really just trying to strengthen these programs that we were working with. And in that, the administrative opportunity popped. And actually, my first year as a coach, she went out on medical leave at the end, about like the last 8 weeks. And I got to actually step in because I had the credentials. And then from there, it became like, hey, we're just going to keep you here. She retired that November. And even when she came back, she was like, you're good. Just stay in front. You're good. And then I did. And then I guess really within that year, I got installed formally as the administrator. So that's how I got to be the administrator in the school district. And that's where I've been for the last 5 years. And again, now I have the opportunity to work on compliance, work on policy, work on, you know, I have a team, a comprehensive team underneath of me that I oversee. And, you know, I get to do more of those administrative tasks. And really our position is kind of like a floating principal. So I have 9 schools across the city, about 50 classrooms, 2 teachers to a classroom. I have an on-site director at each school, you know, which runs the day to day. And then we basically come in and make sure they're compliant, make sure, you know, the things that are happening within the building are right. The teachers are credentialed. They're teaching intentionally, you know, all those, the important things. And our team, we have coaches, we have special needs coordinators, mental health folks, nutritionists, nurses. We have, I'm missing here, family engagement folks, and social workers. So it's a fully comprehensive team that goes in to support not only a child, but the family. So it's nice that we're helping kids, but we're also helping families. We run Head Start program. So what we're able to do, Head Start, I mean, the whole concept behind Head Start is that it's a multi-generational program that provides support so that, you know, families can better themselves. You know, we provide adult classes and all these other things. Yeah. So the goal with Head Start is that really we're just giving them the resources they need that wouldn't be available to them. And we can kind of support them in that. So that's the nice part of my job now, not only helping the kids and the teachers in the classroom, but being able to help the families so that hopefully, you know, the goal is that they're going to help themselves, which will then continue to help their children and so on and so forth. So in that was, that's kind of what put me in the doctoral program. I've always been big on policy. And as I've gone through being in my little bubble and kind of getting out into the real world, you know, you see so many disparities, so many things that are lacking and missing and really not fair for folks. So part of what I did when I wanted to go into the program was find a way that I can eventually get further into the system to help maybe make a change, to help develop policy and make changes to the system so that it works better, you know, for the folks that are in it. That's the goal.
And you're back at Holy Family, right?
Back at Holy Family. And in the end with Holy Family, what I'll gain is the superintendent letter of eligibility, which basically opens up all these other doors that I can get into in terms of, you know, State Department of Ed boards, you know, different chief academic officer positions where hopefully I can get somewhere versus seeing change and being able to make some changes. So that really is the ultimate goal behind being in the program and continuing it. And really it's just to eventually make that difference, to make it more equitable across the board for folks.
Right. And that's kind of your doctoral work, right? Is the kindergarten and pre-K and, you know, equity. So can you tell us a little bit about that, like the equity piece?
I started in pre-K. My student teaching was with pre-K, and I did some time in the kindergarten just to cover both areas. But, you know, it's interesting. When I came to the School District of Philadelphia, you know, and in recent years, you see and hear how much is being pushed for pre-K, you know, in Philadelphia alone, the soda tax. And we're going to push. We want to fund pre-K. We want universal, you know, Philly pre-K. That's great. I think it's phenomenal. But at the same time, you know, you look at the kindergarten level and that's not even a mandate. You know, kids just have to be in school by, I think, I forget if it's 7 or 9 now, but it's like they just have to be in school by 7 or 9. It might have been 9 that changed now to 7. I forget. But that's a problem. We're trying to find all this funding to feed pre-kindergarten. But yet then what happens at kindergarten? They don't have to go. I mean, they don't have to go to pre-K either. But we're putting so much money into these early years because we know it's important. We know it's a big deal. But then at the same time, it's like, okay, let's let it fall flat at kindergarten. There's only 19 states in the country that mandate kindergarten. Wow. I mean, that's unbelievable to me. And only 17 of those 19 require full day kindergarten. Because just around the corner from me in North Penn, they don't even have a full day kindergarten. They have half day, which, you know, parents want their children in school, but they can't make that schedule work. Sometimes it's right. logistically not possible. So now they're either throwing their kid into a daycare program because they can't make that time work for the kindergarten rather. You know, it adds so many crazy layers. And even of all the states, only 39 are required to even offer kindergarten, which means you don't even have to put it out there if you don't want.
Wow.
You know, that's a problem, especially on the back end. When you look at some of these states, not all, but like you see a lot of these states pushing pre-kindergarten because those early years are foundational. Play is important. We're stressing all these things that research are showing. But then when we look at it on paper, you know, in the policy and the systems, it's not there.
Right.
So how do you justify, we're going to raise taxes so that we can get more money for pre-K, but yet it's going to fall flat, you know? So for me,
pre-K, and then you don't even, so you're pushing pre-K, but you could skip kindergarten.
Good. If you wanted to.
Yeah. That's bizarre.
And this is the bigger problem with this is where I always get like annoyed. People are like, oh, you're like a babysitter, like pre-K. You're like, oh, it's like daycare. Well, it is, but they're learning. Like they're still learning, you know, my son goes to a home sitter. Yeah, it's not a functioning school, but guess what? He learns. She does things with them. There's still learning involved in what you're doing. And in most daycares, you know, which is a lot of where the pre-kindergarten programs will fall, there is a structured curriculum. You know, like our programs, we have school-based, which are pre-kindergartens that are housed inside school district buildings. But then we also have our partner locations. The classrooms are funded by the school district of Philadelphia. So they have to follow all the school district mandates, all the standard compliances, but they're housed in, let's say, Adjust Children. You know, like a mom and pop daycare,
right.
But the district is funding those classrooms. They're paying them to have them, you know, so they have to meet our mandates, a research-based curriculum. You have to do so many screen, you know, what have you. But yeah, the reality is that, you know, that's where pre-K then I think gets labeled as the babysitter because, oh, we're only doing it because people need somewhere to put their kids. Okay. Well, in that vein, even if that is why you're putting your kid there, continue it, make kindergarten that way.
Right.
Then continue the babysitting service then. And they're going to learn, you know, even if you want to keep it in that vein, which drives me nuts. But keep it in that vein and they're going to learn, you know, it's so in that vein. So coming back to my work. So my focus is going to be on it's actually came up from a conversation with a friend. Both my Ethan will be starting pre-K preschool. He's 3. He'll be in the preschool program. Sadie did preschool and then went into pre-kindergarten full day, 5 days a week. A friend of mine, her daughter is the same age as Sadie, was only doing 2 days a week. You know, we're close and you hate to compare kids, but obviously you do, you know, especially when you're amongst friends. You know, my friend would be like, Sadie's reading or Sadie's writing. How does Sadie know that? Like her daughter did not, you know, and we would look at it, I said, you got to imagine Sadie's in school 5 days a week, 6 hours a day. You know, your daughter is in 2 days a week for maybe 3 hours a day. You know, it's only a half day program. So, you know, when we looked at that, I said, it's interesting because she's an educator and she understands how children develop and how they learn. But in that moment, it was like, it wasn't making sense as to why Sadie knew more than her daughter. And I have to attribute it to, well, she's in school 5 days a week. You have the same resources I do. We're both educators. You know, the standalone factor to me was that Sadie spends 5 days a week, 6 hours a day in a school. So another friend had actually had a similar conversation. And so from that, I was like, you know what, let's look at it. There was nothing that I could come up with on paper after doing a ton of research that showed the effects of attending a full-time program, which would be 5 days a week, 6 hours or more a day in a pre-K program versus like, let's say a part-time. So which means we're doing less than 5 days a week and less than 6 hours a day. So for me, it's going to be looking at the relationship, you know, is there a correlation between the time spent in a pre-kindergarten program and kindergarten readiness or student learning outcomes in a way? Pretty cut and dry, right? I'm going to look at literacy scores. I'm going to look at student outcomes, and we're going to compare. And as an educator in my head, I feel like I know what the answer is. I'm not sure if it's going to fall that way, but we're going to do all the research. We're going to put it on paper and we're going to show, okay, look, yeah, attending a program 5 days a week, 6 hours or more has a greater impact. And part of me, like I get on these strands, I want to like dig deeper and what effect does it have later on? But I keep getting told, keep it clean. So leave the more greet, you know, the other stuff you want to do, leave that to the side for a minute. Just get a clean cut study out, because if you can prove you can write, you can prove you can do the research, you're going to get the green light to go on any track you want. Keeping it, you know, for me, as simplistic as possible in this vein is going to lay the foundation. You know, it's going to show, look, this is what happens. This is why it needs to be mandated. This is why kids need to be in school. This is the effects. Later down the line, the goal from hopefully from my study will be to then follow and do a longitudinal study.
Right.
Of kids who have been in a full-time pre-kindergarten program and kids who are not. And let's see what that looks like 3 years down the road. Let's follow these kids through third grade and see what those reading proficiency levels look like at that point. You know, so for me, what I want to do is keeping it simple, but it's foundational, because I wanted to lay the groundwork to proving that we need to focus on early childhood, that we need to make sure pre-K is funded and resourced appropriately. And then that follows into kindergarten and that being funded, resourced, and mandated appropriately. Because again, coming back to the district lens, we always get hounded in the Office of Early Childhood because when those third grade reading proficiency levels come out, well, why are they reading at 34%? Like, what happened? They blame it on pre-K somehow. But that gap between pre-K and third, what's happening? Did kids not go to kindergarten? Did the situation shift? Pre-kindergarten, you have 20 kids in a classroom with two teachers. And in Philly alone, when you go into a kindergarten classroom, you're now thrown into 28 kids with one adult. What do you mean what happened? It's not what happened in pre-K. It's what's happening along the way. So Right. Later on, that would be something I would like in terms of a longitudinal study when I have more time and not under the gun with the dissertation timeline, but to see what it looks like.
Starting first and second grade, they're never taking those standardized tests
until
they start in third grade.
Right.
So holy crap, everything you're saying, like instead of the longitudinal study, couldn't you then go and find successful people and backtrack it? Right.
Like, and it's funny you say that because I'm trying to, my study right now has been strictly quantitative, just focusing on the numbers. But now I've been taking some qualitative courses and I'm really like leaning in towards a mixed study, because I think when you do that qualitative, you get the story. You're not just looking at numbers and on numbers, you know, for me, hey, you might have a kid who is only in school 2 days a week and just knows stuff and is smart. And, you know, that can kind of thwart your study a little bit. But, you know, I think it's hearing from the teachers, you know, what are their perspectives, both pre-kindergarten and kindergarten? You know, what are their views on whether kids are going full-time, part-time, you know, what full day and half day kindergarten does for a program, but also families, like why do families, you know, some families do go to pre-kindergarten and they don't go to kindergarten, or they don't go to pre-K and they start off in kindergarten. I want to hear from some families, like what's your thoughts behind why you're sending your child? Why do you send your kid to pre-K? Is it just because you need a babysitter and you have a 9-to-5? Well, you know, what are your thoughts? But what I also want to mix in, something that came up recently was, I'm 37. So I try to gauge like when did pre-K really become relevant? Like I went to pre-K, you know, I say to my husband, he's 45, what's Jeff, 45? And, you know, did you go to pre-K? And so that is a part of one of the surveys I want to do of families. Like, did you go to pre-K? And not to be completely judgy on the data lens, but like, what is your position now? What schooling did you have? Where, I'd be curious to see, is there a connection to folks who start off their education in pre-K and where they end up? It would just be curious. Doesn't make a difference, maybe not, but it'd be curious to see.
And not to say that someone without pre-K couldn't necessarily achieve success, but what does that road look like?
Right.
You know, sure. And maybe the struggles or just, you know, I think it's phenomenal because just for the fact that kindergarten is not mandated, I've never seen a school without a kindergarten.
Yeah.
So I guess that's, you said at 7 years old is when, so you could keep your son or daughter at home.
Yep.
And homeschool them until basically second grade.
Pretty much. And my sister-in-law, she was teaching, I guess it was, might've been first grade at the time. Now she's back in kindergarten, but I'm pretty sure it was when she was in first grade. Like she had children that had never been in school as first graders. They had never been in school before. Like that's, so you talk about like the achievement gap. So, you know, looking at it, you know, classrooms always have those like, you know, a third of each. You got your below, you got your on point, you got your above. But when you have somebody coming in so far behind the curve, you know, as a teacher, obviously it makes their job more challenging, but they'll do it and they figure it out. But when you're trying to reach certain goals in education and trying to close achievement gaps, when you have kids starting off with such a disadvantage, it really does just, it throws that all off. And, you know, there's just so many, again, which kind of comes back to that equity piece. Like, you know, are we setting folks up for failure? You know, we need a system that's setting them up for success, not for failure.
So in Philadelphia, I guess it's hard to say, but like pre-K is really funded by the soda tax, or part of it is funded by the soda tax. So does pre-K get more of a funding than, say, the rest, you know, K to 12?
I'm not too sure the exact breakdown. I know they're trying to find more ways to enhance the pre-K, and I'm not sure because, you know, and a lot of times we always feel slighted in our department because, again, we are solely focused on pre-kindergarten. And when we talk a lot about the district mandate, it's always K to 12, but you have, and it's not even like just partners. It's not like we just, okay, we do the side gig. Like there are pre-kindergartens inside school district buildings, but right. Everything that comes out is always, oh, K to 12, K to 12. Right. Like, but then you want to come back and blame pre-K. You don't even own pre-K at some point, but then you want to come back and blame the pre-K years for what happens in third grade. So I think what it is that there's been a neglect, and I think they're trying to show that, hey, we're putting money into this. The state, I mean, Octel and pre-K counts and all the, you know, federal Head Start, state Head Start. There's a lot of money coming in across the board for these programs. I mean, certainly not enough when you as a teacher look at it, right? As an educator, not a business person, but there is funding coming in. But in a way, what I think they're showing is that they're putting more money into that program. Like, so the soda tax, from my knowledge too, is like that strictly goes to pre-K. Whereas I think there are funds that come in for K to 12 that pre-K does not see.
Right.
So again,
I was just wondering, like in that disparity that you're talking about, like at third grade, maybe you know, it's crazy that you have all this money going to pre-K, but then the funds drop off kindergarten, first grade, second grade. And then you wonder why third grade things aren't as rosy as you would expect. Well,
right.
If there's a dip in funding and an increase in students in the classroom, student teacher ratio.
Right.
Like, well, of course there's going to be a dip from what you would expect.
Yeah. And it's crazy because when we do, like, we have to do like these AIMS reports and we present stuff, and sometimes, you know, our one cohort is Bright Futures, which is the pre-Ks within the school district, which the difference between like the partner agencies aren't union teachers. They're just teachers that are hired through, you know, mom and pop daycare. That so pre-K counts does require certification, a teacher certification, but there's always like waivers that, oh, she doesn't have it yet or working towards it, which is fine. And then Head Start, you just have to have a relatable degree. You know, you could be like a sociology major and somehow they make that, yeah, it's good. You can teach kids. We'll make it work, you know, family studies, what have you. You know, and then we look at, we did like this whole, for me, it was apples and oranges. We compared, you know, let's say some of the partner cohort with this Bright Futures. Now, Bright Futures are inside school district buildings by union teachers. So a union teacher has certain requirements. You need to have level one. And within your certain years, you got to go to level two. You have to maintain Act 48. Like the requirements in that area alone, not to mention the pay differentiation. I mean, you're looking at a good $25,000 at least in pay difference. And then you want to say, why is this program successful and this one's not? Well, this one, the partner agency, the teacher turnover rate's unbelievable. Because right. They kind of either bop around or they're always looking for something that gives, well, that place is going to pay me a little bit more, so I'm going to go there. And union teachers, you have a set salary, you have good benefits, you have a union behind you. You know, you're kind of there. It's a little easier to do your job and do your thing. You know, so sometimes when we look at like, well, why is this program so successful? Well, like it's the elephant in the room. Like it's the different level of a teacher in the position in itself. So, which is always a little infuriating too. And we're comparing things, which is another part of something I'm working on too with a program is looking at, you know, it's almost like a program assessment. So, you know, I have, so my 9 schools vary across the city. Now they're all partner agencies. They're a mix of pre-K counts and Head Start. So they do, I have teachers that have level one. I have teachers that have level two certification. I have teachers with principal cert, you know, at some of my programs. And I also have teachers who are acting leads and they have their associate's degree. Because they just can't find somebody. But, you know, and it's interesting sometimes because there might be that classroom where maybe it is the associate teacher leading. And that's one of my greatest classrooms. Like it's one of my most successful classrooms. So sometimes now what I'm working on in program assessment is amongst my 9 schools, like what makes them more successful than the other? What's happening within this building? And I'm fortunate enough that I have 2 agencies. So I don't work with like, some of my colleagues work with like 7 different agencies. So mm-hmm. I have 7 schools that are associated with Kencrest Learning Services. And I have two that are Mercy Ministry Neighborhood Schools. So it's nice that I have basically like two hubs. So it's easier for me then to do a program assessment. Like, why is my North location more successful than my South location, or vice versa? So that's been something I've been working on too. And it's been like a side project on the doctoral side. You know, what makes a program more successful? And it kind of does come back to that. Some of these schools have all the same disadvantages. They're not in the best of neighborhoods. They don't have ample resources. Their teachers are coming up and being creative and doing what they need to. And so it's looking at how does one make it work and the others don't, or how does this place end up being successful and they have the bare minimum. So that's interesting to see how that's coming together as well.
So Joe, what about you? I mean, I was thinking like you being a third grade teacher, thinking back and looking at this kid who has no pre-K, no kindergarten, and just comes into first grade. It would be interesting to see, you know, I guess for us where we teach, it's a little different because we have kindergarten, but well, I can imagine the difference.
I don't think our kindergarten is mandated. And I was talking to someone the other day that if he's unhappy with everything that's going on, then he said, I'm just not going to send my kid. He's like, I just won't send him because kindergarten is not mandatory anyway. So I'll keep him home for a year and hopefully things will be figured out within that time. You know, and Christy, to what you said, like the culture, right? If part of our homework every night is or because that's a whole nother opinion, right? How do you feel about school and the home connection? If I want school left at school, I don't want to have to read with my kid. I don't want to have to come home and help him with homework. And we all know, you know, maybe a lot of times the assigned homework isn't benefiting everyone. The kids that need the homework aren't going to necessarily have the teacher's help at home to do it. The kids that don't need the homework are just going to fly through it. But I think what is important is reading with your kid every night. So kind of like you said, I've always liked to say, let's track who reads every night with their kid to spend 15 or 20 minutes reading. And how much better of a reader you would be at the end of the year, how many more words you'd be exposed to. So everything you're saying, Christy, like it's almost like it's common sense, right? More exposure is going to equal better success in the academic area, whether it's, you know, starting in pre-K or going through eighth grade in high school and college. I guess there's all kinds of little mini studies that could be done and run, because when there's so much that comes into play, How do you combat culture besides just talking about it, right? Like how I know we've had trainings on ELL because we have a large population of our, not a large, some population of our students are ELL students, and that, you know, they do value school culturally. But from what we've been told, it's like school's at school. And then when you come home, you have chores to do, you know, it's family time. So how do you combat just the attitude where I don't want to spend the time doing it, or I don't want to send them to preschool, or I don't want to send them to kindergarten? You know, like how do you combat that thinking?
It's funny you say that, because we've actually across the years, and even as low as pre-K, like pre-K doesn't really have homework so much. But to your point of the reading, we really a big part of our program is called Lending Library. So again, knowing some of the disadvantages to some of our inner city families and kids that are, you know, just a little bit behind the curve, every classroom is stacked with a library. And this Lending Library system is that the children take a book, and same thing, it's a tracking device, take a few books home and bring them back at the end of the week or whatever your timeline happens to be per classroom. But the idea is same thing. You're going to take a book home because you might not have one at home. So here, take a few home with you. And the goal is reading, and whether it's the parent, obviously pre-K, the parent reading to the child, just go through the pictures, let the child talk. You know, it's a big thing because that is it. It's the exposure. But it just in that vein and others, even across going back to the middle school. And, you know, I've actually sat in meetings where parents have actually said, that's not my job, it's yours. And I'm sure you guys have heard it or at least heard stories. It's not my job to do it. That's your job. That's what you're paid for. I don't need to sit with my kids. So you're right. Like, how do you battle that? Like, how do you attack that? Like, yeah, this is my day job. But this is like, as a parent, like, isn't this what you want for your child, for your child to flourish, to grow and to, you know, be ahead of the curve and better them. And it's a very, very uphill battle when you encounter, you know, some of these non-compliant, whether in a negative way or like you're saying, that culture. I'm like, hey, we come home, we have things to do. We actually have, I had an issue a couple of years back we had a fam, we had a child at a location, and the numbers that we do letter and sound recognition, and the numbers were atrocious. Like the child had like zero letters, maybe a couple sounds, like no growth whatsoever. And when I go in my admin meeting and I have to present, and this is what's happening, and you know, because that one kid, if there's only, we only assess the incoming kindergartners. So the little guys, we got 3, 4, and 5, but we only assess the children. We assess them all, but the ones we look at in terms of our data collection are the ones that are going into kindergarten. You know, so if you only have 5 kids that are going to kindergarten, if a child has 0 letters, 0 sounds, obviously it's going to bring that class's percentage down. So it came up in a meeting and we were talking about it. And they're like, well, what's with this kid? Like, what are your coaches doing? What's your team doing? You have special needs on it. I said, yeah, but when we sat down with the family, this family was in crisis. They were evicted from their house. They didn't know where their next meal was coming from. So you know what? In the scope of things at that moment, ABCs were not the important piece. You know, this family didn't know where they were going to live. They didn't know if they were getting food. They didn't know if they were getting clothing, like what was happening. So yeah, in that moment, the crises that some of our families are in, especially in some of these inner city schools, is, you know, we don't even know, you know, and we don't get into that. And that's what I like about my job. We're able to get into the family lens as much as they'll allow us, you know, but that becomes the priority. So now we do have to shift, like, okay, while the education is important, obviously housing and food and survival are more important. Same with when the whole kind of 2020 election went down, or back, you know, when Trump first came on board, and in my South Philly location, you know, Head Start, they don't have to be legally documented. Like they don't have to be, but again, the push that we want kids in school, we want a better folks. Right. So we had a lot of issues with attendance. Why aren't kids coming to school? We had families that were afraid to leave their house because they thought ICE was going to snatch them on the way out. But yeah, so we have families afraid to leave their house because again, now the fear is a real life reality that these folks are going to be taken from where they are, their children taken from them. So, you know, on top of all of the educational fronts that we're battling, you know, there's a whole other lens behind the scenes. We don't know what families are dealing with. You know, we never know what someone else is battling, right? I always tell my kids, always be kind. You don't know what anybody's going through. Maybe they had a rough day. But the reality, you know, when some of these parents don't care, it's not that they don't care. It's there's maybe just so much more happening that they just don't know how to balance yet. You know, and again, with our program, we have that opportunity. We have social workers, we have mental health workers, we have nurses, we have nutritionists, we have all these people so that when these situations do arise, we hopefully can get in there and get them the resources they need and to be able to then obviously better themselves, which can then better the child, which is kind of the whole partnership, right?
Yeah, so I guess that's that whole social-emotional learning piece.
Which is what's so great about, I guess, the public school system is it has all those resources because it's funded by, you know, federal funds and state funds. So I guess that's it. They can have what's it called, boots on the ground, right? And get people where they're needed.
You know, but here's the kicker with this. Again, kind of talking about the layout and the framework, which again is where some of the disparities go. You go from having this, you know, which is a part of it is the Head Start model, but that's a part of the public school system, right? It's ingrained in our public school system. So and you have all these resources available to families, even let's just cut the kids out for a second. You have all these resources available to families to support them as well. Now we move on to kindergarten, first grade, second grade. It's not that districts don't have, they have a social worker. It might be one for the entire region. Right. It might be one for the entire tri-county, what have you. It's not the same. It's not as simple as calling me and saying, Chris, I need a social worker down here ASAP. This family's just got evicted. You know, this is, hey, call the hotline. You know, so the resources become less and less as we kind of climb this ladder, which is baffling again to me because you're putting folks in this vein, especially if you start in a school district with pre-K. You know, then you go to kindergarten, you're like, hey, where's that lady that helped me with family services? Or where's that nurse I had? Now we're lucky if we have a nurse in the building twice a week. You know, right. So again, you're like overloading folks on the front end. But then as you climb, it's like we're slowly pulling all that back, but then expecting you to still be successful, if not more successful than you had been.
Right.
Which again, that's the system. There's a framework.
Maintain that level.
Right.
Without all the resources. And it's not, I mean, they're going from all those resources for just a few years, what, 3, 4, and 5, right? If they're right. There for all 3 of those years. Yeah. And now for the next 12 years, you don't have them and they get less and less as you go.
Yeah. We're with the district, especially with like, we think a lot with our special needs kids, you know, the services, especially in this pandemic, you know, kids are, you know, we always say kids are behind the curve just because of the pandemic. Okay. Like, well, kind of like they're all in the same boat. So we're all right. Going to be behind. But then you think about these kids with the special needs and services, like these kids didn't get services. Like right. Up until probably June, maybe late May, my schools were not even allowed to have therapists in. Like, so these kids are either maybe doing some sort of tele-Zoom and tele-appointment type thing. And so now these kids are even at a more of a disadvantage, you know, but then like, so as you go through the grades now, you know, you might have a coordinator in a building because some of them do have a coordinator in a building. Otherwise you're calling down to the OSS, which is the Office of Specialized Services, which is like, yeah, you're lucky if you get a call back next Tuesday, you know? So it's just like, you're again, the system is failing. You're not providing enough to have these folks be as successful as they could be. So that's kind of the tough part again. And I know, you know, a lot of it is financial. A lot of it is the resources, the availability, the funding and all of that. But it's like, we got to find a middle ground.
There's not enough butts in the seat on that end to fill all the positions or do you think there's not enough people out there to help all the people in need?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think, and it was funny, I was having a conversation with my cousin yesterday talking about, you know, even just teacher, you know, shortages and what have you. Yeah, I think part of it is that maybe there's not enough folks maybe, or we can't have, you know, we can't have this whole comprehensive team probably at every school and every level, but it's like, you do need to find a way. You got to make it more, the word slip in my mind, but you have to make it more appealing, you know, to folks to want to be here. You have to put into your staff if you want them to be able to get a buy-in for your program as well. So we definitely have to find more appealing ways to draw folks in. Some of the things that happen within the district are not always the most appealing, and folks don't want to be here, or they want to do their 9-to-5 and that's it. They don't want to go above and beyond. So the value and the respect on both ends does have to shift, I think, too. But, you know, I think there is a need for it. And I think there are people to fill it. I'm just not sure why, you know, they can't get it. And I know budgeting is huge. I mean, we're facing a huge crisis, you know, right now, I think, again, within the district about cutting and what are we going to cut? What are we eliminating? What are we not bringing on? So I know it's hard. And when I was talking with the superintendent, a friend of mine, he, you know, he said it's part of the hardest job. That's the hardest part of this job is trying to be fiscally responsible. You know what needs to be done, and you know what, you know, you have to get done. But then you're met against this budget that you're trying to, you know, so it maybe isn't always, it's not all maybe ill intentions of how it gets done, but there's just, it's got to be done better. And I think that's where it comes into those higher levels. It's not things we can change on local levels or even state levels. It's got to be more of a nationwide, you know, what are we investing in? What are we doing?
Well, yeah, I just,
why doesn't it look the same across the board? That's a whole other conversation for another day. But like, even within my programs, like state entities, like it's whose hat am I wearing today? Like the state isn't even on the same page. Like something stupid as like bookshelves can be bolted down. Bookshelves shouldn't be bolted down. Like if the DPW comes in, they want to see this. If human services come in, they want to see this. It's like, you can't even get on the same page. So I got people jumping through hoops or, okay, I can't please you today because they came yesterday and I'm set up for them. Like that's a bigger problem. Like in across our nation, I don't think we're on the same page.
It's funny to hear you talk because I've been teaching, I think this is going to be my 15th or 16th year starting in September. And after this tough year, like I feel so frustrated. At one point, I just wanted, and I had this once around 7 or 8 years in, and it changed everything. But I got so frustrated 7 or 8 years ago. I'm like, you know what? I want to just go pound nails. Like it would just be so much. I know there would be stress, but it wouldn't be this type of stress. And right. And after, you know, the start of Corona and then all last year, I wanted to be done. And as I start to look back, like I spent so much time, like I care about education. Like even sometimes when I start talking about things and Ron knows, you know, you get so emotional and you hear it in your throat. And yeah. You know, as a guy, I hate feelings. I hate, I specifically hated feeling like that. But like you said, like, it's almost like, yeah, maybe it is time to be done in the classroom, but go like I've applied to a few state, our state Department of Education, a few positions there. Cause I feel like, you know, why don't we have teachers on special assignment? Why don't we have, you know, after being in the trenches, I feel like, hey, listen, maybe now it's time to get some stripes on my sleeve. But I think the way to do that is instead of just apply, like I have a bachelor's with a few credits towards an instructional technology master's. I think now it's full force getting the master's in administration and then pursuing something either in New Jersey has a Department of STEM. So either the Department of STEM or just to really try and, you know, in the classroom, you're affecting the lives of and families of between 18 and 22 kids. But then to sit there and see like the policies and everything that are in place, and the heads bump, you know, like, to me it seems stupid, and not that I would be able to go in and change the world, but to go in and I like to say on the bottom of my emails, I'm not trying to ride. No, I don't want to make waves. I just want to ride them. But you know what? Like, I think someone, like you were saying, someone needs to make waves. And just like, I get so frustrated. So yeah, like, I think that would be, you're kind of inspiring me, Christy, to really like,
oh, that's good.
take the plunge. Cause I feel like, yeah, that is the biggest, sometimes our biggest obstacle is as a teacher, like, we see what needs to be done, but because of the shackles, right? Like, we're chained to these stupid ideas.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, I recently was in a conversation in one of my classes, and it's kind of like, and my sister, Ron's sister is a nurse. And, you know, it's like, when you think of the hospital scene, like, the nurses typically know probably more than some of the doctors. You know, they're in the trenches. They know what's happening. They know their patients. And same thing, like, we don't value teachers across the board in that same way. Like, for me, I go into the teacher, like, you tell me, like, you know, as an administrator, I swore, because being a teacher, I didn't always feel my voice was heard. I always had, well, why'd you do that? What was that for? Like, so my approach as an administrator, I'll go in and I want the teacher to tell me, hey, walk me through what just went down. Like, hey, kid was sitting on your desk. What was that about? Like, talk me through it. Like, I got berated for a child sitting. I was teaching fifth grade. The child was very autistic, lots of special needs issues. And he happened to be for our math lesson. He was sitting on top of his desk because he sat still and he focused. And for me, I don't care if you're sitting on the windowsill. If you are sitting and I know you're engaged, I'm okay with that. And one of our like big wigs, it was like, I forget, she was more of like a special assignment woman, but like the wing was like named after her. So she was really a big wig. She was really smart, but she actually happened to be doing a walkthrough with our principal. And my Moses was sitting on his desk, on top of his desk with his copybook in his lap. And I got brought in at the end of the day. And they're like, listen, like, Shelly was here and you, Moses was sitting on a desk. And I'm like, oh, like, oh, okay. Like, what's wrong with that? They're like, well, why? And I'm like, because did anybody else, like, nobody took notice that Moses was sitting. Moses was usually running around my room, out the hallway, back in the bathroom, usually calling for somebody else because he's running through the halls. I'm like, how come you all were so quick to point out that Moses was sitting on his desk, but didn't take the minute to say, wow, Moses was sitting? Like,
yeah,
that was such a huge moment for me. And I think that was a big game changer for me, that it was like, in that lens, because I was in that administrative lens already trying to work towards it. Like, you can't just jump out of the gate and say, what the heck was that? Or why the hell were you doing that? You know, there's a story, and you need to hear that story, and you need to hear whether, okay, that's ridiculous. Let's not have that happen again. Or, wow, good for you. That worked in that moment. You know? So it's like, you really have to have that. Like, teachers usually know what's going on. You know, they have an understanding. They're doing things for a reason. Now, is there not to say that there's a couple crazy things along the way? Absolutely. But for the most part, they're there.
Learning might not look like 20 kids sitting in rows of four or five students listening to the teacher talk.
Exactly. And learning's different for everybody. And even again, at the pre-K level, these are things that are instilled. So let's just take circle time, morning meeting. It's a quick 15 minute. You know, for me, if you have all the kids engaged, do I want to see them running all around the room? No, because they're supposed to be learning what structure looks like. But listen, if you got a kid sitting in the dramatic play area because that works for him right now and he's in tune to what's happening, I'm okay with that. Like, you know, if he's obviously completely off task, that's going to be something we're going to talk about and work on how we can improve. But if you have attention and if one kid happens to be laying back and you know, teachers are, oh, sit crisscross applesauce. Everybody crisscross applesauce. Well, I don't like sitting like that. Maybe he doesn't like sitting like that, or, you know, catch a bubble. Who wants to walk around like that? Like, that's not everybody's take. Like, that's not what it has to look like. Or it doesn't have to look like that, like you're saying, for all 20 of them. Learning, we talk about individualization and how important that is. Then don't stereotype them and don't put them all in the same basket in terms of what they need to do. Just doesn't happen. You know, and that's until, you know, and I think that's what happens. And I think I find myself, I try to catch myself now that I've been out of the classroom for about 5 years. You know, you do sometimes forget. That's why I'm humbled. Like, I'll go back in the classroom. It's like, oh, let me read today. Let me do a lesson. Just to kind of remind myself, like, Chris, it is like bad sometimes, or this is what it looks like, because you do get removed and you do forget. You forget what should be happening in a classroom. And you're so stuck on, you know, as an administrator, I have a lot of agendas that I have to, you know, see done. And I have a lot of things that I have to make sure are in compliance. And you know, again, I always try to go back to that teacher lens. Why doesn't it look like that? Or how can I support them? Because again, you kind of do, when you get removed, you forget what that classroom looks like and what happens in the daily emotions and feelings and struggles and challenges. So, you know, it's something that I'm big on. I really need to remind myself. I constantly, at least once a week, I'm in a classroom teaching, whether it's a mini lesson or something, a model lesson for a teacher, what have you. But because I think as an administrator, you need to be humbled because you can't forget where you came from. And because, you know, it's easy to do that.
It sounds like you're switching between, I can hear it in your conversation where you switch between almost like teacher and administrator, but I can always tell, I could always hear the administrator when you've used the word compliance a couple times.
I know, it's ingrained.
And being in compliance. And, you know, I talk about the stress of the classroom and a stressful year. So I couldn't imagine as an administrator, you have 9 schools underneath your belt. So I'm assuming you don't go in to an office.
Not as much as I would like. I have one and I didn't see it in pandemic, but yeah, I mean, sometimes for some quiet time, I'll get in there, but you know, for me and my philosophy, even going back when I first started out and I was interviewing for principal positions and, you know, I always swore like, not that I'm not sure I ever want to end up there, but it's on the table. But, you know, as a principal, like, you know, you need to be seen. Like I can think to schools that I've been in. I'm lucky if I saw my principal 5 times in a week. Like for me and just from some of the good principals I've worked with, you know, you need to be in those classrooms. You need to be staying abreast of what's happening day to day so that you can honestly support those teachers and be there. And for me, I've always described my leadership as almost like a servant leader, you know, like I don't need the power. I like the titles. I like the position. I like some of the you know, the perks that come with being an administrator, but that's not it for me. Some people in the doctorate program, they want the title. I'm not going to run around being called Dr. Nober after all this. That doesn't do it for me. For me, it's the idea of just gaining more knowledge, being able to support. I need to know what's going on and I want to walk with you, not behind you, not over you. That's the goal because again, I think of some colleagues who they're more of like the fear mongering, which works for them in some aspects. But for me, I'm so really leaned into relationships. And I tell any new staff member I get, any new coaches I take on, you know, I had a new coach come on in the middle of pandemic. And how hard is that? Like you can't even go in the classrooms and meet folks. But I'm like, you just need to find a way to build relationships. Because if you don't have relationships with folks, what's going to get accomplished? Either they do it out of fear or just when you're there because, oh, she needs to see this. Versus when you have a true relationship with folks and a true respect that goes both ways, you know, they're going to try those things that you want them to do. They're going to be a little more compliant in certain aspects. And we need to throw out new things, right? Like, hey, I need you guys we need to switch up gears and do this. And when you have those relationships established and honed in on, I think it makes a lot of that much easier. And I think on the teacher end of it, you know, maybe you have more respect and value because you feel more of a partner as in the process versus like, you know, the constituent type thing.
Well, with your students, it's all building relationships. So if from the top down, there's relationships being built, then it just shows the teachers, this is important to me as an administrator. It should be important to you as a teacher with your students.
And it's funny because even at the superintendent level, right? So I was working on a case study and they were talking about the relationship between the superintendent and the school board members, which, you know, all that gets pretty dicey and hairy. And the school board members were speaking to the fact that they're like, we can't even tell you the last time the superintendent sat in our meeting. So, you know, just as with students, you know, if craziness is happening in the classroom, it's on the teacher. Like, what's the teacher doing? Are you there? Are you present? Are you showing them? Just as a parent and a child, are you there? Are you present? Are you working with them? You know, when you kind of stay away or you remove yourself from the picture, you know, you wonder why quality decreases. You wonder why people just say, mediocre is okay because you're not here. You're not setting an example. Why do I, you know? So I thought it was even interesting at that level. Like, it's, you know, as a superintendent, yeah, you probably have to be a million places, but you do have to find time to carve out those important times to be with folks, the stakeholders that matter, the staff that matter in terms of if you want their buy-in, then you have to be right there with them. You know, you can't just be speaking from your ivory tower expecting X, Y, and Z to get done, but yet you are not leading by that example. You know, so I thought it was interesting that you see it across all levels. If you want that buy-in, then you have to be dedicated as well. And you have to show it, you know, in your actions. Yeah, but I think that's just so important too. And I think for me, like, and it was one of the biggest takeaways when I took the position with the district, my administrator at the time, she told me, she said, listen, 90% of this job is relationships. She said, you need to be able to develop relationships. And it was one of the things that I took with me and I spent, I had been removed I had been removed from pre-K for such a good while. So I wasn't up to speed on the standards, on the curriculums, on what was needed. So I spent, you know, while I was learning and brushing up, I spent time talking to folks. What's going on? What do you see? What do you need? And for me, I truly think it's what made all the difference.
You know, I know when Ron and I first kind of started everything, our new superintendent actually came on as curriculum coordinator. Do you remember, Ron, the first tech expo we went and yep. we were kind of learning about making? And I remember sitting there at lunch and our other buddy Gary was like, yeah, you guys can come in anytime you want. And I remember saying, I'll tell you what, I'd be nervous. I'd be extremely nervous if administrators came into the room when I was trying something new and wasn't sure about the whole, you know, making and going back to like constructivist learning. I was deathly afraid. So, and that was probably about 5 or 6 years ago. And now she's become our superintendent. And it's because of the relationship that we have built over the past couple of years, you know, like as a teacher administrator, and just even beyond that, just as being able to go talk to her as a friend, I can say it's because of that relationship. You know, I still feel a little shaky at times trying some, not just the new curriculum, just like the new ideas that are out there and discussing the new topics, but it's a lot less shaky because I know I have a really good relationship with the administrators for sure.
Yeah. It makes such a difference.
And it's not something, and I know they're, you know, all in. So it's not just, let me do it. Like you were saying before, let me do it the one time that they're here for the observation. You know, they're out and about, and I think that shows they're all in, which helps with the buy-in.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's funny that story. Kind of, I laughed because when I was at the Northwood Academy Charter, and I was getting observed, and I guess because I was still new, so I think I had them twice a year, even I don't know, maybe three times a year. But you know, for me, I don't care. Come in and see me Monday, Tuesday, whatever. It's not the dog and pony. Like I see a lot of dog and pony shows right. in my line of administrative work right now. But you know, I remember thinking she was coming in. She's like, all right, I'll be in on like Thursday. Well, it happened to be like a test review. And I was like, oh, do I like revamp my whole lesson plan because she's coming? But no, like this is what I would do. And again, we had a very good relationship. So I was like, I left it. Like it was literally a whole literacy review that we were doing for our chap, you know, our novel we were reading. We had the whole ELA block. It was just, we had game. It wasn't just a mundane, like, hey, we're doing this. Like we had stations. It was this whole thing. It was nice. It was a good review, interactive, you know, and she came in. And I remember like in our post observation, she's like, listen, like you had like a test review. Like, why didn't you tell me? I'm like, well, what does it matter? Like this is, and to me, if I'm going to, I want to see that. I want to see how you're preparing.
You want to see all types.
Right? Like I said, I'm not going to give you a dog and pony. I'm not going to say, oh, let's just do a vocab lesson just because like, this was on my schedule. This is what the kids were expecting. Why would I change that? Like, this is a part of my job. It might not be as glamorous as a lesson I might have done for just a new topic or, you know, revamping something. I said, but this is the reality. And I want real. I want real. And I always say that to my teachers, like, don't do fake. Fake is so obvious. Just do you. And if you are a good educator, if you're committed, if you're doing your job, even on your bad days, you're still doing it right. You know, like, and that's all I ever ask for, even with my staff, like,
well, and because you as an administrator for yourself, at least you realize that you're seeing one lesson out of hundreds of lessons.
Exactly. It's interesting that like you just have this vein, like I want, like you can't forget that you were a teacher. 99% of administrators came from being a classroom teacher and a nervous, scared, frightened one at that. Like you can't just negate all that as much as the pressure and the stresses of what the job may require. There's a lot of stress. Like, and there's things that like, that come across my plate that I have to really think about for a few days before I present it to my team, because I know it's going to suck. It's going to be a hard conversation. I know they're going to look at me like I'm bat crazy. And you know, it just, I got to figure out how to do it because it has to get done, but I got to figure out how to make it make sense to them. And that's a big thing for me as well. Like I always have to have the justification. You know, I hate people that just come back out and this has to get done. Well, because it has to get done, because it came down from the state. They want it done. Well, justify it. Give me some sort of reason as to why it needs to be done so that I can comprehend it, understand it, and make it work in my classroom or my setting or what have you. You know, I have to ask folks to do crazy things almost probably daily, but I always have to try and make sure like, okay, like humor me, this is what we're doing. And even if it's some far-fetched connection, at least if I can show them like, listen, I'm trying to support you, trying to make it work. And this is how we're going to, you know, get there. And that's important for me. And I think it's funny too, is that I feel like it's cost me a couple of positions because I haven't come out headstrong and I'm the leader. I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. Like, I don't think some folks like that.
Do you mind if we switch gears? Just
no.
So we were on we did the 100 days of conversations about education with the Human Restoration Project. And in that, we were talking a little bit about how play is losing a little bit of ground in like kindergarten. Like I know for myself, when I went to kindergarten, there was some academic work, but there was a whole kitchen area and a dress up area. And I think that is being taken out of some kindergartens. And I just, as a more early childhood focus on in your work in education, like, how do you see that affecting grades going forward, you know, that move away from play in some of the early grades?
You know, it's interesting. A friend of mine, too, also did a whole dissertation. Her entire dissertation was on play and the importance of play in the early childhood setting. For me, I think the biggest thing is that people often associate play with, like you said, it's not academic. They're not learning. When you think about play in terms of the early childhood years, this is where they're learning to communicate. This is the most simplest, natural form of learning. They're problem solving. They're communicating. Their fine motor skills are being developed without even realizing it. They're discovering their independence. These are all things. These are those social, emotional, foundational skills that set up success. I've had conversations with kindergarten teachers that say, listen, I don't care if they don't know their ABCs. Can they sit in their seat? Can they listen to direction? Can they communicate with their classmates? Can they express their feelings? That's what comes out of play. And the fact that, you know, I think of conversations with my sister-in-law who teaches kindergarten, like they actually, you're not allowed to have centers. You're not allowed to have the games, the kitchen, the dramatic area, the dress up. You're not allowed to have that according to them because we're so academic driven. But the problem is if you don't have the foundational skills that come out of playing, teamwork, cooperation, communicating needs and wants and problem solving, conflict resolution, these are all the things that lay the groundwork for a successful academic career. Because think about it. Think about some of our most problematic kids. What are some of their issues? They can't communicate. They can't articulate what they want. They can't problem solve. They quit. They give up. These are things that if you encourage play and facilitate it, obviously, in an appropriate way, you're going to have all these things come out. Pre-K alone, like the curriculums are research-based. They're play-driven. You know, they're child-directed, play-driven. We want them playing. I mean, heck, even some of the most serious situations that we've learned about families and kids have come out through play. You know, watch. You want to learn things about home life and family life? Watch dramatic play. Watch dramatic play in 3, 4, and 5-year-olds because you will learn everything. You know, so to go back to the whole point and the effect it has is monumental. Because if you don't have those foundational skills of problem solving, communication, socialization, I mean, that just sets you up for failure forever, I think. I mean, I look at some of our...
You should watch the kickball games that I see for the third graders. Like you just said, like problem solving, communication, it can all be seen and learned through, and like you said, structured through a kickball game. Because if they don't have it, they do. They get upset. They walk away. They'll sit and cry, which at the end of the day isn't going to solve their problem. So yeah. I'm a huge kickball fan.
Yeah, I mean I think about like even when you watch some of this stuff on the news, like man, did this kid ever like did he have friends? Like did he play? Like what's happening? Like why are they so? Just some of the things that come out of it, it's unbelievable to me. And when folks say like, oh, well, they're just playing, but you know, and as teachers, particularly in pre-K, all of their anecdotal, you know, observations and assessments can come from a session on the playground or just watching them build blocks. And you can learn so much from that. And then from what you're observing, you then guide the lessons. You then guide them. You sit with them, show them maybe what has to happen next, or you talk through, okay, well, you're not happy. So what can we do? And, you know, those are the important parts. Like that's a big area where even with our teachers, they struggle. How to facilitate it. They see it, but how do they hone in on it to support it, to help them grow? And like I said, just from we do a Building Bridges program with the kindergarten teachers, and they will tell you, like, listen, the academics is not, I'll get that. Like, they're like, I'll get to that. I will make sure they know their letters, their sounds, their numbers, everything in between. But if you can just get them to where they can communicate, they can problem solve, they understand feelings and emotions, which again, that's not something you're standing in front of a classroom lecturing. You're doing it through play, through games, through, you know, what have you. It's their outlet. You know, it's the most for me too. It's when we talk about like observations for special needs or just behavioral or anything in between, you know, people say like, let's put them in the room and let's grill them and ask them questions. No, put them on the playground, put them in the dramatic center, put them in the art center, watch them in their most natural environment to see what they're doing, because that's where it comes out.
And I was thinking, I mean, when you were talking, like there's this big push to the four C's of education, right? The critical thinking, creativity, collaboration, and communication. They're all there in play. You have every one of the four C's being demonstrated in just a play area. And it Joe, it really reminded me, I don't know, Christy, if you're familiar with Angela Stockman. She has a book called Make Writing. And she's all about using like blocks or Legos. And her thing is build me your character for kids who are writers or what we would consider struggling writers who don't want to write, build me your character. And she'll have them build out of Legos, or she'll have them give them a bunch of natural materials and have them build their character out of a pine cone. And she was talking about how you can see that developmentally, this kid might not be able to put it on paper, but they can put a character together, and they have this high level of thinking because they chose to use the pine cone because this character is kind of prickly and not so nice. And there were all these metaphorical things that they chose the pine cone for, or the rock, or whatever. And so we just had her episodes out now. We just had her on the podcast, but it reminds me of that. Like the play helps facilitate even writing.
Yeah, for sure. And I think even now you're seeing it, as much as they drive me bonkers, but even just like in the whole fidgets, you know, if right. I sit in an adult class and they're like, here's your box of fidgets, pick a toy. And I'm like, but again, it's that concept of, in a way, it's a form of play, right? You're coloring or you're playing with the pinchy things or those popper things now, those pop-ups. You know, it is a form of play, and it does trigger different senses of the brain that allow you to do different things. And I think like you're saying, with struggling, you know, students, we always think about how can we see what they understand? And you're right. It's through some of those build me something, you know, draw me something and paint me something. And, you know, hey, can you act it out like in dramatic, you know, like tell me the story, and they'll go in dramatic play and they have the characters. And what happened in that story? Oh, this was the bear. This was, you know,
right, you can see the whole thing through that. You can see the scene, the setting, the plot, everything.
Yeah. It is. It's so crucial. And I always say, I keep telling my friend, I want to get through her dissertation, but I just don't have the time. But you know, it's the research on it is unbelievable. And, you know, when you hear that phrase, oh, they're just playing. Yeah. But that's so important. Like,
do you think there's, it almost reminds me of like one of those, you squeeze the tube of toothpaste out, right? you know, and standardized testing is so prevalent, and the curriculum is so prevalent now. Do you see a push where someday there will be play centers back in a kindergarten or anything like that?
It's interesting you say that, because then here's the administrator hat. That's the problem, right? You're under so many stressors. You have to meet so many requirements, so many needs, so many different, you know, whoever you're attending to, and you got to meet all these criteria. And unfortunately, the push does come there. But I think the problem is, you know, where the push comes from, are they understanding? So I think that's where it comes back to good administrators, good superintendents. How is it that you're conveying your message? Yes, you have to meet all these requirements, but how is it that you're going to get there? How do you achieve greatness? You know, yes, we have to do curriculum stuff. Yes, we have more standardized testing, but how does that look in your classroom? You know, it doesn't necessarily, yeah, you have to do the curriculum stuff, but hey, maybe try working this in. So I think that's where I think it's a little undone right now. I think that's a great example, Ron, with the toothpaste, because we've put so much pressure and stress on the academics and keeping up with the world and what have you. We don't have time for this. And until somebody comes along and shatters that whole theory that this is it. And even though there's a ton of research on it, there's still, you're going to need that one leader to say, hey, I'm breaking the mold. I'm going back to this.
Right.
You know, you're going to need that one bold person to say, you know what, we're shifting it. This is what needs to happen. And we're like, I think of Katie, you know, our sister-in-law. Yeah. She said, I don't care that you tell me I can't have centers. I have centers. I'm having centers, and I'm going to do centers because that pushes the rest of my work. So I think it's that's the thing. It's finding enough people that are willing to kind of go against the grain to bring it back in. You know, we're again, this vice versa, where we're pushing from the ground up now and saying, look at the influences of play. A lot of research on it right now, a lot of work being done on it. in the early years. So again, hopefully if that shift can kind of start to sway, you know, the pendulum in the other direction, that's where you're going to see, okay, maybe we need to see it work back in. So I don't think it's completely out of reach, but I think it's going to take a while and a few bold folks.
Well, we definitely appreciate your time. I know you have a lot going on.
I know. So
dodging like, Nerf balls.
And the head. Yep. You'll see them. Not even sure what he just knocked down, but he targeted. So again, like we celebrate successes. He shouldn't have shot the gun, but he totally knocked down the cup. So bonus points, right? I don't know. Find the silver lining.
So yeah, I mean, again, thank you very much. And Joe, do you have anything else?
No, you know what, Christy, like, I think you definitely lit a little more of a fire underneath my tail to really try and pursue that, not necessarily a principal role or administrator, but to get into that state, you know, Department of Education and really try and start to push for some change, not just in the classroom or a school, but overall for the whole state.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I appreciate the conversation.
Awesome. Me too. And as I said, nothing else that, you know, even now when I think, am I going to be a superintendent? Absolutely not. Especially after the conversation I had the other day with the superintendent, I have zero interest. I don't. I think it's fascinating. I'm glad he does it, but not my cup of tea. But you know what? It gives you a seat at the table.
Yep.
And that's what, you know, when you've been in it long enough, and I don't even think I've been in it nearly long enough, but you know, it just at least gives you that opportunity to get your voice heard and to be at that table and hopefully get something out and hopefully something good comes of it.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah.
I know it's like throwing pebbles at like a mountain, but
pebble in a pond, right? Makes lots of ripples. Yep. So there you go.
Lots of noise to be made.
All right. Well, thank you again.
Teacher nerds knocking on your door. Open up, let's take your teaching further than before. Give it a try, don't be shy, there's nothing there to lose. Worst thing that happens, kids get pain on their shoes. We're talking teacher nerds.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Teacher Nerds Podcast. Keep up with every new episode by subscribing on Apple Podcast, Spotify, Google Podcast, Anchor, or anywhere you listen. When you subscribe, be sure to give us a review and tell a friend. Visit us at teachernerds.com. Follow us on Twitter at Teacher Nerds, on Instagram at Teacher Nerds Podcast, or email us teachernerds@gmail.com. And remember, we're nerds with a Z. Most importantly, thank you for listening and becoming one of the Teacher Nerds.